Greetings. Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, today on July 6, 2003, coming to you from Campbell Hall here in Urbana, Illinois. Our guest today, joining us on the phone from Michigan, where I don't think it's his home, but I think it's a holiday he's on this week, is James Weinstein, the longtime editor and the founder of the weekly and now biweekly newspaper magazine In These Times, based out of Chicago. And we've had Craig Aaron, the former managing editor of In These Times, as our guest in the past. James Weinstein is also a very prolific and prominent American historian. He's written several books. And he has a new book out, The Long Detour, The History and Future of the American Left, where he reflects on his activism, his research, and thinks about the patterns of the American left and what it means for the future of socialism in the United States. Joining us today again, James Weinstein. Jim, are you there?
Yep. Hi, Bob.
Thanks very much for joining me, Jimmy, on this Sunday. You're up in Michigan, is that right?
Yes, thank you. Yeah, we're in Michigan for the weekend.
And this is just a holiday, or are you doing a speaking tour?
We have a cabin here.
Very good. But you're based in Chicago still, is that right?
Yep.
And what is your connection to the In These Times newspaper currently that you founded and edited for so many years?
Well, very little, actually. I'm on the board, and that's about it.
So basically, this book you've just written has occupied your time for some time now.
Yeah. I left the magazine in 1999, and started on the book about 6 months later. So that's basically what I did for the next 2 years, and since then I've been trying to promote the book some, and so that's where I'm at.
Well, that's what we're going to do today, then, because I think the book really relates closely to the whole mission you had behind In These Times. I mean, it's very closely connected to your
right.
political project, as you make clear right at the beginning of the book. I mean, In These Times was all about trying to popularize socialist politics in the United States, make left ideas part of the mainstream. And this book is about that project, is it not?
Yes.
So what's let's start with some basics. What do we mean? Wait, Jim Weinstein, I have news flash. You just set the all-time Media Matters record. We got our first phone call in. I mean, is this your wife calling or something, Jimmy? What is this all about? We got a phone call even before I announced the phone number.
She just went to the grocery store, so I doubt that it's her. But
unless she's on the cell phone. Okay, well, let's take the call before we even get started. Let's see what's going on here.
Right.
Line one, Champagne, on the air with Jim Weinstein. Hi, you're on the air with Jimmy.
Well, hello. No one will be surprised to hear that it's me, the first caller. But anyway, I was just listening to the previous show on NPR. It was called On the Media, and it was talking about the BBC and that it's been cut off, or Israel has cut off relations with the BBC. And it talked about the fact that there had been a show on the BBC about Israel's weapons of mass destruction, and they interviewed someone from the Israeli government who talked about the quality of the show in terms of certain kind of sensational aspects, like, and they had this, you know, background music that was used when they were talking about this nuclear plant. And so I guess my concerns are many. On the one hand, it seems like some of the BBC's accusations are not really dealt with enough in the media about weapons of mass destruction and assassination attempts and but assassinations carried out against Palestinian officials, terrorists, whatever. And, you know, this wall or fence that's being built. So it seems like they're covering important issues that aren't necessarily being covered elsewhere. On the other hand, Israel accuses them of anti-Semitism, and they're basing that on this kind of sensationalism that it seems that the BBC is competing with other news outlets and taking on a kind of an American style. But I guess my concern is that the content, most of it anyway, seems to be accurate, although I'm not sure about the accusation that Israel has used chemical weapons against these Palestinians in the Gaza Strip recently. But, well, my concern is, well, whether, you know, the ability to criticize Israeli policy and have it not become, you know, be accused of anti-Semitism. And I guess I'd just like you to talk about the left and Israel and these kinds of questions.
Okay, well, thank you, caller. Yeah, Jim, I mean, before we dive into your book and the history and future of the American left, this is an issue I know that you've wrestled with as editor of In These Times from 1976 to 1999. How to cover the Middle East, the relationship with Israel. How do you respond to what she said?
Well, I've been writing editorial since we started the magazine about Israel and the Palestinians and the West Bank, and we've always taken the position which we said was inevitable and which even George Bush has come around to, that they'll never settle this thing until there is a Palestinian state in the West Bank and until Israel withdraws to its 1967 borders, which, of course, is still not anything that Bush has committed to. We lost a lot of our Jewish readers in the course of this, accusing us of anti-Semitism also. So that's a problem. I mean, I think the BBC does a great job.
Yeah, I know Irwin Knoll, the late but great editor of The Progressive for two decades until his untimely death in 1994, had the same problem or issue too, because he was supportive of the rights of the Palestinians to have their own state, and it cost him dearly, he said, mm-hmm. in terms of support.
Yes.
Well, let's go now to your book, The Long Detour, The History and Future of the American Left. And if, for those not familiar with your work, you've written several books on this topic. I mean, this is really a culmination of a life of research as well as activism, including The Decline of Socialism in America, Ambiguous Legacy, The Left in American Politics, The Corporate Ideal and the Liberal State, 1900 to 1918. Let's talk about socialism, which is, I think, you know, at one time this book is going to be called Whatever Happened to Socialism, as I recall. That was the working title. What is socialism? What does that term mean?
Well, that's the problem, and that's why this is called The Long Detour, because what it meant in the United States and what its influence was before the Russian Revolution is fundamentally different from what it means today to most Americans, and in fact probably to most people in the Western world. The socialist movement in the United States was a very large popular movement that played an extremely important role in humanizing American capitalism, especially as it entered its phase of being dominated by giant corporations. And many of the ideas that the socialists had and their programs and so on came to be adopted, some during the Progressive Era and others during the New Deal, and many of them now are thought of by most people as just part of capitalism. Social security, the right to organize unions, the 8-hour day, the 40-hour week, unemployment insurance, environmental protection, women's right to vote, civil rights, and so on down the line. In the early 1900s, these ideas were considered to be way out. And although they were not the exclusive property of socialists, the socialists either were the ones that came up with them first or that were their most consistent advocates. So the socialists played a very important role. They had a lot of influence. And a large following among people, and were their ideas were very seriously considered and discussed at all levels of American society.
What about the idea, Jim, of socialism as an economic system, where we hear about it as, you know, like the communist system, where it means there's not private ownership of the means of production, that's owned collectively or by the state, and the profit motive isn't used to direct the economy. You don't have free markets. Where does that fit into what your vision of socialism is?
Well, the point that I was sort of halfway through was that all of this, that the role that the socialists played was extremely important in the development of our modern society. But that the movement then, after the Russian Revolution, the meaning of the movement was turned on its head, because the Soviet experience was a revolution led by socialists in a country that had none of the social, economic, or political prerequisites for the kind of society that socialists talked about before 1917. Karl Marx loved capitalism, and he said capitalism was the most amazing system that had ever existed in the world, that it had was developing and industrializing society and science and everything else at an incredible rate, and that it was creating the conditions under which you could have a society in which the basic principle was the full and free development of every individual. And the United States, he believed, and possibly Britain, were not only the most advanced capitalist countries, but were also the countries that were beginning to develop working classes and democratic ideas that might lead to a peaceful transition to socialism. Well, when the Russian Revolution occurred, it threw all that into turmoil because it occurred in what was the most backward, the most primitive state, and the whole Soviet experience for 70 years was the Communist Party acting as a surrogate for a capitalist class and pursuing a policy of forced industrialization and modernization. So by the 1930s, socialism, instead of meaning what it had meant in 1917, came to mean to most people a lower standard of living and the absence of democracy. And the Russians or the Soviets called their system real existing socialism, and the anti-socialists in the West, especially conservatives and even liberals among the politicians and corporate leaders, were more than happy to accept the Soviet definition that their system was real existing socialism. So today, if you talk about socialism to anybody, what springs to their mind is a society that is dominated by a very small elite in which all decisions are made centrally and so on. This was never the idea in the earlier stages, and we are now in a position in American society where we have the ability, the resources, and the level of productivity that we could create a society in which, indeed, the underlying principle would be the fulfillment of in which every person could be fully developed as a citizen and as a cultural person.
We're talking to Jim Weinstein today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Jim Weinstein is the founder and longtime editor of the Chicago-based weekly and now biweekly In These Times, which I'm sure many of our listeners are familiar with. He's also an American historian, and his new book, just published by Westview Press, is called The Long Detour, The History and Future of the American Left. We're talking about that book today. If you'd like to call in and ask Jim Weinstein a question or make a comment, the number here at Media Matters is 333-9455. The toll-free number is 1-800-222-9455. Jim, I've had a chance to read the book over the last couple of days, and it's a terrific read. It just you sail through it. It's hard to put down. You have a great line in there referencing what you're just saying about how after the communist experience, socialism became perceived as something with where people would have a lower standard of living without democracy. As you said, hardly an attractive concept if you're trying to mobilize mass support.
Right.
Well, what is the relationship of socialism to the left? I mean, are they the same thing, basically, in your view, interchangeable? What's the relationship between those two
concepts?
Well,
I think our society in its present form has both socialist and, of course, is dominated by capitalist principles. The capitalist principles are acquisitive individualism and free trade and protection and of corporate profitability. The socialist principles are human welfare and humane social policies. Now, in our capitalism, both those principles are interwoven, but as you can see in the Bush administration, which adheres much more closely to the capitalist principles, the humane welfare issues are under steady attack, and there is a conflict between those two sets of principles. In my view, the socialist principles are, of course, the humane humane ones. And the point is of the book that we have now reached a level of development in the United States where it is possible for everybody to benefit fully from the level of productivity that we have if only we had different social policies. So I don't really deal with the question of private ownership or of the means of production. I don't think that that's a meaningful thing to discuss at this point. In fact, one way of looking at the society that we have is that there is very little left of individual economic rights and ownership, that corporations are, in fact, socially owned through their stock systems, and that it's really a question of who owns them and who controls them. What I propose in just as ideas of that we might pursue are policies that would speak to the situation that we find ourselves in today, especially in terms of employment and meaningful employment and ways in which people can spend their lives in socially useful activities, and also at the same time be able to develop their own thinking, their own understanding, their own education throughout their lifetimes.
Now, as I read the book, Jamie, I see that the book, The Long Detour by James Weinstein, our guest today on Media Matters. As I read this book, I mean, I see you're making an argument that the period from the Russian Revolution until the fall of communism, rather than being the real history of socialism, is sort of an anomaly.
Yes, that's the detour.
And that there's actually a rich tradition of socialist politics in this country prior to 1917, which we need to link up to again. Is that a fair assessment?
Well, yes, it is, except for one thing, and that is that really the left has stopped thinking, and stopped thinking by the 1930s, of ways in which the United States could transcend the negative aspects of capitalism. The programs that they advocated in the early 1900s have pretty much all been incorporated in one form or another into our society. But the nature of our economy has changed drastically, especially since World War II. And what you have now is, instead of an ever-increasing working class, that is traditional working class, people who think of the working class as blue-collar workers and factory workers, and the left, there are many people on the left who keep calling for investment and reindustrialization as a way, this is just one example, as a way of increasing employment and bringing back jobs. But in fact, we're in a situation where every time there is reinvestment or reindustrialization, we lose jobs, so that we produce more and more with fewer and fewer people. If you look at the automobile industry, for example, in 1950, there were 1,300,000 approximately auto workers, and now there are maybe 300,000. Only we produce maybe five times as many automobiles as we produced then. And this is true in every industry, and it's particularly true in the industries that are involved in electronics and the internet and computerization. So the problem that has faced capitalism since the World War II is what to do with these tremendous numbers of surplus workers that are developing. And that's how the consumer society developed, and how we have come to a society in which is valueless, and which in which the primary purpose of life is to accumulate goods and money, and who has the best car or $100 shoes and so on. And of course, the left gets attacked for this by the conservatives. because this is very threatening to all of the old standard social values and habits. So that the family, for example, it's torn apart not by the left. It's torn apart by the need for two worker families, for mass consumption by families. And at the same time, everything in the media pushes this idea of self-fulfillment, but self-fulfillment measured purely in terms of consumption.
Jim, if I can interject here. So is this argument meaning that the traditional way of thinking about socialism, the left, as being industrial workers really misses the boat today?
Absolutely. Because there, in another 20 years, there won't be any industrial workers. There'll be a few thousand, a few hundred thousand.
Mm-hmm.
And so we have to think in terms of what this society offers today. What are the social possibilities? What are the resources that we have available? And what are the national priorities in the way in which we use these resources? Well, obviously, the way in which we use them, and this is especially true in the Bush administration, is to put hundreds and hundreds of billions of dollars into the military, armaments, and all of the other associated things, whether it's, all of the so-called counter-terrorist policies, which, in my opinion, only increase the amount of terrorism, and reorient the society to use those for socially useful, progressive activities and policies, especially in areas like education and healthcare, but also in many other ones in culture, like doing something like the old WPA, the Works Progress Administration of the 30s, which had the WPA arts projects and cultural projects, which were federally funded. So that's basically what the argument is.
We're talking to Jim Weinstein today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. James Weinstein is the founder and the longtime editor of the Chicago-based biweekly news magazine In These Times. He's also a noted American historian and the author of the new book, The Long Detour, The History and Future of the American Left, which just came out just within the past few weeks and is getting a lot of acclaim. I've read it. It's a wonderful book, very readable. If you've read Jim Weinstein's work and In These Times over the years, you know that he is a terrific writer. For those of you who are interested in staying on top of the show Media Matters, we have a weekly email that we send out, and you can sign up to get this email. We don't give it to commercial interests. You'll only get an email from us, and you can get off the list at any time you want. All you need to do is write our producer, Kumi Silva, at K-U-M-I-S, Kumis, at UIUC.edu, and she'll sign you up and you'll get the weekly email. It gives information, like in this case with Jim Weinstein, links to stories and articles about his book and his background and In These Times and upcoming guests in a way you can communicate. So it's KUMIS at UIUC.edu.
Bob?
Yes, Jim?
Can I put in a plug?
You certainly may.
Okay, you can also get it from my website at jamesweinstein.com,
mm-hmm.
which will tell you a little bit more about the book. It's got some excerpts. It's got a table of contents. And it has a direct link to Amazon to buy the book.
Now, Jim, I've got to tell you, I don't know what the weather's like in Michigan, but down here in the heartland, we occasionally get tornadoes and twisters, and we've got a weather watch. So right now, we're going to go to our weather watch for about 45 seconds, and we'll be right back.
Okay.
The National Weather Service has issued a severe thunderstorm watch for the following counties in the WILL severe weather coverage area: Champaign, Coles, DeWitt, Douglas, Edgar, Moultrie, Piatt, and Vermilion, effective until 6 p.m. this evening. Hail to 2 inches in diameter, thunderstorm wind gusts to 70 miles per hour, and dangerous lightning are possible in these areas. Repeating, a severe thunderstorm watch is in effect until 6 p.m. for Champaign, Coles, DeWitt, Douglas, Edgar, Moultrie, Piatt, and Vermilion counties. This joins a tornado watch, which is in effect till 6 p.m. for Ford and McLean counties.
Okie dokie. Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Our guest today, James Weinstein, the author of The Long Detour, The History and Future of the American Left. 1 week from today, our guest on Media Matters will be Saul Landau, the Latin American expert and media critic who will be joining us. 2 weeks from today, we're going to have the editor of The Nation magazine, Katrina Vandenhoevel. And 3 weeks from today, another editor, this time of Adbusters up in Vancouver, British Columbia, Callie Lassen. But today, our guest, Jim Weinstein. Jim, as you were talking about how the society has changed radically and the left has to do sort of a rethink of its relationship to the social forces in the society, it made me think immediately of the new left, which came about in the 1960s, which was a rejection of the sort of traditional socialist and communist view of how society is structured and which class alignment and how it worked. And you write about the new left in The Long Detour. That was a generation that where you cut your teeth, so to speak. I mean, you were heavily involved in left politics during the 1960s.
Well, I was. I didn't cut my teeth.
Your teeth were cut by then.
Yeah,
to date you. But your teeth were well cut. But you were active in that period politically. What's your sense of the new left? Do they offer a roadmap for us in the future?
Well, the interesting thing about the new left is that when it started, and especially with Mario Savio and the free speech movement in Berkeley and the SDS Port Huron statement, it understood the potential that existed in the post-war world for a life of a meaningful life of fulfilling activity. And Savio talks about it. The Port Huron statement talks about it. But Savio also made the point that this tremendous increase in higher education that occurred after World War II, and this is something that people don't realize, before World War II, about 11% of high school graduates went to college, and mostly those people were either people who were going to become doctors or lawyers or engineers, or ruling class or upper middle class youngsters who were being trained to be sophisticated, educated members of a ruling elite. After World War II, in the 60s, more than 50% of high school graduates were going to college. And what Savio did was he denounced what was happening in this process, that although this provided the opportunity for leading really fulfilled lives, it was being used just to train people as cogs in the corporate machine. And the symbol of the free speech movement at Berkeley was the IBM cards that were the first in the early computers. They were run by IBM cards. And their slogan was, "Don't spindle, fold, or mutilate us," which is what was printed on the cards. So there was an understanding that we were in a different situation, and in a situation that created much greater possibilities for self-fulfilling lives for everybody. Unfortunately, that sort of got dissipated and lost as the new left developed. And that happened partly because the new left thought of itself as something that was unique and brand new, and they were creating a left out of the full cloth. And that, in turn, that happened because they rejected both sides of the Cold War. They rejected the Soviet system and the Soviet Union, which they didn't see as a particular threat, and they rejected the policies of American capitalism, especially once the new left became essentially an anti-war movement and movement against the war in Vietnam. And so they never studied or were interested in the experience of the left, the historical experience of the left. And what they ended up with was a movement which was the first left, not only in American history, but in world history, that was essentially a movement that rejected the working class and the labor movement. And this came about because the labor movement at that time supported the war. So they were against anybody who was for the war. And by rejecting all of the experience that the left had had in the previous 100 years, they were left to replicate the same kinds of experiences without understanding what they were doing.
And in the book, I should add, Long Detour, you have a pretty nice discussion of this where you go into some of these precise examples of what you're talking about.
Yes.
We have, Jim, I just interrupt here, we have three callers who are patiently waiting. Let's go to the phone lines right now and let them talk to you directly.
Okay.
Line one, Champagne, you're on the air with James Weinstein.
Yes, hello. I just read a book review this morning in the Chicago Tribune about a book by Todd Gitlin called Letters to a Young Activist.
Yes.
Which I think relates to some of the comments you've been making. Although, from reading that review of the book and knowing a little bit about Todd Gitlin, it sounds like a pretty bad book. And
I wouldn't recommend it.
But I'd just like to know what, you know, but it also sounds like you're sort of saying some of the same things that he was saying. And one of the things that the article pointed out in particular was not just the the general problem of the new left in relation to violence and so forth, but black power. And I think another thing I would throw in there refers to the first caller. I think there was also a conflict within the new left when the whole Jewish issue came up after the 67 Arab Israeli War, which really, you know, divided, was sort of...
Well, actually, no, that's not true, because the new left by that time was pretty much already splitting up and about to disintegrate. I mean, that process started in 66, by late 67. For example, I was an editor of a journal called Studies on the Left in the 60s. It started in 1959 in Madison, Wisconsin, and then moved to New York in 63. And we folded the magazine in 1967 because we saw and believed that, number one, we'd achieved our basic priority or purpose, which was to legitimize left or socialist or Marxist ideas in the academic mainstream, and we'd pretty much achieved that by then. But also because the new left itself was just... Was just going off in all kinds of directions. And it really had nothing to do at that point with Israel and the Middle East. We did run one article by, which was a review of Eichmann in Jerusalem, a favorable review by Norman Fruchter. Which got a lot of flack from some of our Jewish readers or some of the Jewish conservatives. But that really was a very minor part of what happened to the...
When Todd Gitlin... I mean, Todd Gitlin has a problem with black power, but the subtext of that problem that some Jewish intellectuals had with black power is that black power was, you know, rejecting the significantly Jewish leadership.
Yeah, but that really came later. That really came after the New Left. All of the pro-Palestinian stuff in the Afro-American movement.
But what about just the Black Power issue itself? I mean, what, you know, I think it's just too...
Well, what about Black Power? I don't understand what...
Well, you know, I mean, Todd Gitlin can go off on the mistakes that the new left made in terms of its relationship with the notion of black power.
Well, but he's talking about the Weathermen in 1969, when Bernardine Dorn at the Weatherman conference and at other conferences after that said that the blacks were the vanguard of the revolutionary movement in the United States. But even Weatherman repudiated that when the Black Panthers called for a united front against the civil liberties restrictions and oppressions that they were suffering from the FBI. And at that point, the Weatherman condemned the Black Panthers as being nothing but reformists. So this was simply rhetorical. To the extent that it was, of course, Gitlin may be correct, but
Jim,
really...
I, want, I want to go on to our other callers. Before I do, let me just tighten up this one point. Todd Gitlin's new book, for those our listeners not familiar with it, could you just give a précis of it?
No.
Okay. Have you read it?
I have not read the whole book. I have read parts of it, and I've read all the reviews, and I know Todd very well. He's an old friend of mine.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, we have our disagreements. But I don't think it's a good book because basically it's a book, it's a complaining book. It's a whining book,
mm-hmm.
which is a characteristic that is nothing new with Todd, unfortunately.
Okay, well, let's go back to the phone lines. Line 2, Champagne, you're on the air with Jim Weinstein. Hello?
Yeah.
You're on the air with Jim Weinstein.
Oh, no, that was me.
That's you, okay.
Oh, okay. Champaign County is what I usually go by.
Okay.
So I'm actually in lovely Urbana.
Okay.
This sort of is of a piece, and I was just going to ask it more in a general, the old left formula, the problem of faction. And maybe you can illustrate it by your own experience with in these times, too, I think, in the sense that there was in the Central America wars, there was a lot of consternation with your ex- writer John Judas, ex-colleague, I assume you have differences with. Mercifully, he was against the Iraq War, and he rebelled at calling the New Republic neoconservative on a chat show the other day, which I found surprising in both regards. But so I don't know if you really want to rake over those coals, but the whole idea of what kind of generalizations can you make about, or insights do you have about that, just the whole idea of how much time we spend with factions spinning our wheels against each other. And
well, you know,
a reasonable. It's kind of open-ended, and I just wanted to.
Well, I have two things to say, both of which probably are irrelevant. In 1914, the First World War started, and socialists of all countries had always opposed World War, and they had gotten together and they had passed all these resolutions in which the socialists of every country swore that they would never support their governments in a world war. Well, then the war started and all the socialists supported their governments. And the result of that was a lot of disillusionment. So in the United States, the Socialist Party, which had been on a straight line upward trajectory until 1914, suddenly sort of hit a roadblock and it suffered some losses, and there was a lot of infighting. So Victor Berger, who was one of the socialist leaders, was asked about that, and his comment was, when business is bad, the partners start to quarrel. And my experience is that the less there is at stake, the more you will have factions and criticism. When there is a left that is doing well, that has a clear idea of what has to be done and is growing, and there is some chance of some success in the social or political arenas, factionalism drops to a much lower level. So that's one aspect of it. The other aspect of it is that the kind of factionalism that we know really is a product of the fights between the communists and the Trotskyists after 1929, throughout the world, and of the whole nature of the communist regime in the Soviet Union. And it really is a product of that Soviet experience. It's not that there was never any factionalism. In the old socialist movement, there were many different factions, but the interesting thing about it is they were all part of one political party. They were all part of the Socialist Party. When it came to elections, they all voted for the same candidates. When it came to publications, they read the publications. And most socialist publications, whether they were right-wing, left-wing, or center, ran articles by people from the other factions. They had a clear point of view. They had an editorial position or line, but they were open to people who had different points of view. And there was genuine discussion and openness of differences. Now, there'll always be differences. And that's not the real question, and neither is there any reason why you shouldn't criticize other people if they say things that you think are incorrect or unprincipled or whatever. But it's the way in which you do it.
So
in a growing movement, you will find that that kind of thing goes on in a civil and constructive way. And in a situation where we are powerless, the only thing that people have is their correct ideas. And so they fight like hell for their correct ideas, none of which are correct.
Okay, we're talking to Jim Weinstein today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Jim is the founder and longtime editor of In These Times, the Chicago-based newspaper, and the author of the new book, The Long Detour, The History and Future of the American Left. You can learn a lot more about The Long Detour at Jim's website, jamesweinstein.com. Is that the correct address, Jim?
That is.
Well, let's go back to a very patient caller who's been waiting for us from Dixon. You're on the air with Jim Weinstein.
Yeah, hello.
Hi.
I have a real problem now with what I term the war of fog that we're going through. And essentially, there's a couple of facets to it. For instance, I don't know if Weinstein is Jewish or not, but there's an awful lot of people who are good practicing Jews who are now being called anti-Semitic because they oppose Israel. You've got the problem of Kucinich, who is being called on the left, where in actuality, he goes back to Roosevelt and Truman, you know, he's almost reactionary in a lot of things he says. This idea of symbol, you know, where people are being called anti-American if they're against the war in Iraq, including, I suppose, Robert Byrd. You know, and the whole idea of generalizing into a term, that term then becomes a target for the propagandists who are fighting the war of fog. And you lose the ideas, you end up arguing symbols back and forth, which become very emotional rather than actual issues. And I think that it's really important, especially if the media would do it, that we get down to the actual issues, the actual arguments, instead of just throwing around terms and these grand symbols. Maybe instead of calling the left or socialism, those terms, maybe we should call them the Red Brick Party or something which is undefined and which can't be latched on to.
Well, whatever you do, if you're on the left and if you support certain principles, you're going to be called a socialist or a communist, and there are different ways of handling it. I used to have that argument with some friends of mine in Santa Monica in California, who ran for mayor and actually were elected, and they were constantly being called socialists, and they kept insisting they weren't socialists. And I said, listen, I don't care whether you're a socialist or not. I said, but the point is, the more you deny that that's what you are, the more you perpetuate this as an issue. And the way to deal with things like that is, well, this is what I stand for. And then you say what you stand for, and you say you can call it whatever you want. The important thing is, these are the principles that I believe in and that I'm espousing, and do you or do you not like these principles? So, in essence, I agree with what you're saying.
Jim, he mentioned Kucinich, and that really leads to the concluding part of your book, and I know a lot of your work, which is getting the left involved successfully in electoral politics in the United States, not just at the presidential level, but at the congressional, state, and local level. And you, well, first of all, do you have any comments on Kucinich? Who is?
Yeah, I love Kucinich. I mean, we wrote about him when he was mayor, a lot about him when he was mayor of Cleveland. And in Congress, he's played a very, very constructive role. He's been very, I don't know how influential he's been, but he's been a very consistent in the support of most left principles. There are things that he has espoused or opposed that I've disagreed with him on, but that's true of just about anybody you could mention. So, but overall, I think he's a very principled person, and that I agree with most of what he stands for. Whether it comes to supporting him or Howard Dean or somebody else, is a different question, and that's a practical question of who might have a real chance of getting the nomination. But the more people there are like Kucinich who are doing what he is, the better.
Now, part of your political project is talking about which route leftists or socialists should go in the electoral arena. And what's your take on the third party movement in general, looking historically and at the present?
Well, you know, as you know from reading the chapter, third parties had a very important role to play before 1910 or so, before the introduction of the primary system, the open primary system, because the two main parties were essentially private monopolies. They have evolved as quasi-state institutions, which have rules and regulations that make them accessible to any individual or group of individuals who wish to intervene in the system. And the electoral system that we have is one that mitigates against third parties, because we have a majority system for the executive branch. We're not a parliamentary system. And therefore, third parties, except under extremely difficult situations or circumstances, have been really dead ends, and even worse than dead ends.
What does that mean? Off a cliff? I mean.
Well, worse than a dead end is something that puts you instead of advancing your ideas or your position or your strength, weakens it. That was true, for example, of the 1948 Progressive Party, in which Henry Wallace ran as a progressive, and that's how I got into the left. By the way, I was very active in the Progressive Party and in the Young Progressives. But the result of that was that he took this issue outside of the Democratic Party, and in doing so, all of those who followed him were then eliminated from mainstream politics. Senator Claude Pepper, for example, in Florida, who was one of the best liberal senators in the Senate, the man who ran as his vice presidential candidate, who was a senator from Idaho, I forget his name. Lots of local politicians, state senators, state assemblymen, if they supported the Progressive Party, the Democrats dumped them, and then that was the end of their influence within mainstream politics. In the trade union movement, the unions that supported Wallace were all expelled from the CIO, which they had been under attack anyway, but this provided the means by which they could easily be dumped out of the union, and other unions were organized, which then grabbed up all their members and so on. So it was, in the long term, it was a disaster for the left. It just totally isolated the left. And, you know, we had that argument, you and I, in regard to Nader's campaign in 2000. So, to me, such campaigns, especially at this point, when they are brought as independent campaigns, what they do is they split the people on the left between those who are operating within the main party system, whether in the Republican or Democratic Party, mostly Democrats, and those who are fighting it from the outside. Instead of unifying them, it just divides them, gets them into hating each other, and so on. And it really doesn't matter how popular the person who is doing it is. I agreed with almost everything that Nader said in terms of the substance of what he said, but he could just as easily have said all of that in the Democratic Party primaries. And he would have gotten much more exposure. He would have built a constituency that would have survived the election instead of having totally disappeared, along with himself. There could have been a process of building a movement. Now, this may very well happen from what Kucinich is doing. Kucinich is drawing crowds which in many places are similar to the kind of crowds that Nader was attracting, and the same kind of enthusiasm among the same young audiences. But he's doing it within the framework of the mainstream political movements.
Do you think that the ideas that Nader has and say that Kucinich has now in the mainstream press coverage, to the extent Kucinich gets covered, and he's rarely covered, or if he is, he tends to be lumped together with what are perceived as the other marginal and irrelevant candidates.
Yeah.
Do you think those views are sellable? I mean, is there a following? Could he actually win a nomination or an election in this country with the values and views he has? Or are his views, which are generally left views, progressive views, the kind that you espouse, are they just hopelessly marginal in our society today?
Well, at the moment, they're hopelessly marginal, but the only way to make them non-marginable is to be espousing them in front of the largest number of listeners as you can and the people who are most interested in politics, and to build on that. Now, I don't know how much he'll be able to build on it. Part of it is that a lot of his ideas are being espoused by Dean, although a lot of them aren't. You know, a lot of people look at the two of them and say, well, Dean has a better chance, so let's go with him. But the extent to which they participate in the public debates, the televised debates, I mean, Kucinich has already had more television exposure, even at this stage, a year and a half before the election, than Nader had in his entire campaign. So as far as the general public is concerned, at least they are being exposed to these ideas, and they're beginning to think about them, maybe, we hope. And they have a way of connecting that to people who have some real chance of getting elected to office. Now, in my opinion, the left, the presidential elections are the least important place where the left should be involved in the serious process of trying to elect someone, because we're not going to be able to elect a president, if ever, for many, many years. But we are able, even at this stage, to elect some people to state legislators, to Congress, and so on. And that's really the point, that this can be done in primaries and congressional races where you don't need a majority to get nominated to a Democratic or Republican, as a Republican or Democratic candidate for Congress in many districts. You only need 10% of the vote or 12% of the vote. So,
Jim, you know what? The band is tuning up in the background, which means they're kicking me out of the studio, which means its time has come to an end on Media Matters today.
They can't do that to us.
I'm sorry about that. I want to thank James Weinstein for being my guest today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Jim Weinstein's the author of The Long Detour, The History and Future of the American Left. And please join me 1 week from today on Media Matters. Until then, I want to thank Kumi Silva and Brett, Juice McPickles, and Hambone. Bye-bye.
Thank you, Bob.